What if the shoulders of the giants we're standing on in the future are a Microsoft or an NVIDIA? What if the GFS model that we get from NOAA today isn't needed anymore, right? Like, these are big questions and really worth spending time thinking about. What does that look like? I mean, the entire box you just talked about no longer exists.
Welcome to the Triple Point Podcast, a podcast for those working at the intersection of weather and climate, technology, and society. We focus on innovators and leaders working to make our community safe and resilient in the face of a dynamic and ever-changing world. I'm your host, Ryan Harris. And if you're looking for a weather episode that is going to challenge conventional wisdom and make you stretch outside your comfort zone, what may be the first in a series of outside-the-box episodes kicks off with Scott McCarrow. He's the head of insights and innovation for Vaisala X Weather and is an established leader in the atmospheric science community, specializing in areas of predictive modeling, machine learning, and environmental monitoring. Scott received his meteorology bachelor's from Millersville University of Pennsylvania, master's and PhD from the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and has been a thought leader across the public and private sector with consequential roles at Vaisala, AccuWeather, ClearAg, and more. Finally, he's an entrepreneur and has even started his own nonprofit, 1000 Gretas. Are you ready to innovate across weather and climate, technology, and society? You will be after this episode. Let's dive in. Hey, we are excited to have Scott McCarrow on. He's at Vaisala currently, but he's hopped around to a few different locations around the weather, water, and climate enterprise. We're going to do things a little bit non-standard from our past Triple Point podcast episodes here, though. And this is going to be a little bit of a out-of-the-box riff session, whiteboard session, whatever you want to call it. But we are just going to spend the next 30, 45, 50 minutes just innovating back and forth. And we'll talk, I think, a little bit about artificial intelligence and what that means to the weather, water, climate enterprise. We've talked about that on past episodes with Amy McGovern and John Williams, Brent Shaw. We had the commercialization of weather as well. A lot of good episodes previously that are, I think, are building on a foundation for this episode. Scott, it's so great to have you on the podcast. We had a chance to meet at AMS in Baltimore last month, and I really appreciate, you know, your style, the way you communicate, and we had a chance to talk to some young early career students. But welcome to the show. Really happy to have you on today.
Great. Thanks so much. Really excited to be here, Ryan.
So Scott, one of the first questions we always like to ask our guests is just understanding your journey up to this point. How'd you land at Vaisala? I know you've had a really intriguing kind of pathway to get there.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is kind of always my joke because I really just have no idea what I want to be when I grow up. I think the reality is that's getting clearer for me as I'm getting older. But, you know, I am and have always been a people person, and I've also been very fascinated by science and technology. There's always a catalyst in life, and for fortunately or unfortunately, depending how you look on it, the movie Twister came out in 1996, which is when I was 16 and kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do. And it convinced me that weather would be a really solid career to be able to work with people and science and technology. So I've absolutely spent my career trying to find ways into roles that allow me to do both of those things. Practically, that's meant predictive modeling, so classic numerical weather prediction and AI applications in a variety of roles, government, academia, private industry. I learn from one role, move on to the next, and try to find my way into having as much of an impact as I can.
Wow, when I look at your bio, it's like a smorgasbord, a buffet of menu options that you've been able to sample throughout your career. And I think that really gives an interesting and diverse experience there for sure. So as I kind of alluded to, this episode, it's going to be a little non-standard from a typical Triple Point. That's a mouthful. and maybe we'll start an outside the box series. I don't know, but let's set the stage here. Before I left the Air Force, I was down at Hurlburt Field and I supported some Air Force Special Operations. And I really just absolutely love a quote that they had down there. And it goes something a little like this. In AFSOC or in Special Operations, we think outside the box. And when there's no box, we make one and then we think outside of it. So my big question to kind of kick us off and that's going to set the foundation for this episode is, why is it important for us to philosophize about ideas that challenge conventional wisdom?
Really good question. You know, to your quote, I can't remember who said the other one, but maybe there just isn't a box, right? It's a whole other way to think about it. But I think the way that I think about your question though, Ryan, is that the only real constant is change, right? And if you get too comfortable with the status quo, you just kind of quickly find yourself outdated before long. There's some psychology that, you know, humans can accomplish a lot of amazing things, but we're kind of inherently lazy, right? Oppose things that are inconvenient. But just because it's inconvenient or, you know, conventional wisdom is comfortable, right? It doesn't mean that we have to stay away from them. You know, so I love the quote from the Air Force because I think it encapsulates that well.
Yeah. Comfort is what I've seen. We're going to dive into this and why the federal enterprises or just government in general, it's not just federal. This can be at the state and local level too. And this is actually big corporations too. They get comfortable in their way of operating. And so the incentives aren't quite as there maybe for that outside the box or innovative thinking. So when we think about government and we think about the incentives there, what is the government positioned well to do? And where should the government continue to really invest in private sector and academia and others to really push to enable the innovation envelope, if you will?
You know, at least today, the government's role really is to put the money forward for the infrastructure, the measurement infrastructure, to ensure the, maybe we say compliance or, you know, the foundation, the scientific foundation and rigor that's necessary to do this right, to run those models and pay for the supercomputing power that, you know, doesn't really make a lot of economic sense for industry to do. And then, of course, there's the entire National Weather Service and alerting and all the other things that come along with it. So the government plays a very big role today. It's an interesting question. And as we continue here talking about AI, I think it may become clear as to why the answer to that is not very clear, right? When I don't know the answer to something, I often kind of go back to history first and work my way through it. And I think it's kind of worth thinking about how, gosh, if we even go back to what, the mid-1900s, right? Most technological advancements were happening in the government. One example that was always brought up for me was sort of the phone mattresses, right? NASA invented that for space travel and then industry commercialized it. Although admittedly, I've never actually validated that story. I think that's just been told to me. So hopefully that's true. But you know, if you fast forward to today, you know, most of us have really enjoyed advanced global numerical weather prediction as an example, right? All the processes associated with it coming from large government funded organizations. And the conventional wisdom as to why that is because they have access to the computational power and the money associated with it that many industry players simply couldn't justify. The government also played a big role in ensuring that the scientific foundation was there. They had the leeway and the patience, which unfortunately doesn't always exist in industry, to really make sure this was done right at scale in a way that was cost effective, right? Groups like NOAA puts out the GFS model, right? You've got ECMWF with the IFS model, UK Met Office, DWD and others. All these organizations have been putting out these models for us. I mean, not to say that they're like the mattress, but really, right? They've invented something that was very powerful that industry realistically couldn't do themselves historically. And industry it's been a huge economic driver, right? Not only economic driver, but maybe more importantly, they put out this very life-saving technology, right, and made it available to the world. I think the reason why I sigh when you ask me, like, what's the role in the future? Because if you look over the last decade or two, private industry has really kind of taken the lead on the post-processing technologies, right? You can consider those sort of the last mile products and services. How do we take these technologies that the government has made available and kind of turn them into something that's useful for the end user itself, right? business-to-business applications, forecast services, and of course, most people are familiar with mobile weather apps, right? Those are really good examples. Of course, we talked about AI at the beginning, and AI is playing a much bigger role, almost an exclusive role in that side of the house right now. You know, a lot of us will admit that we've kind of stood on the shoulders of these giants for a long time, these giants being government organizations, right? They're leading the development to a lot of these technologies and making this available. To think about where it's going on in the future, you really have to pay attention to what's happening in weather kind of outside of the government space now.
I think that's a good segue. When I kicked things off, I was talking about, you know, maybe this will be an outside the box kind of conversation. So let's define the box in the weather world. What is comfortable for the government? What is, you know, the status quo in academia, the public, private sector? I know you said earlier, you alluded that maybe there's not a box, but maybe humor me for a second. And like, what is that comfort zone? And then I really want to go take that to the next level and like, all right, how do we think outside that?
The box of today begins with the measurement networks, right? Whether it's surface-based, remote sensing, satellite data, and governments still are responsible for the lion's share of creating the foundational measurement capabilities that drive everything from getting weather data to numerical weather prediction and beyond, right? Huge costs, a lot of rigor involved in that. We are seeing some shifts in that space to more and more commercial players, especially in the low Earth orbiting satellite space. That information gets aggregated, curated, and of course, put into these. I can't understate how sophisticated the data simulation technologies of the world are today. Some of the most advanced mathematics I've ever seen, right? And that's not just government. I mean, now you're incorporating some academic institutions and, you know, research labs and so on and so forth. That process is largely taken care of by government organizations. And then that creates the analysis that drives the numerical weather prediction. And those models are also at the government's academic and lab space, right? Then the execution of those models, how do you run those on the supercomputing? So you've got governments paying for the supercomputing power, you've got them running the actual models and then delivering them. Now, even the delivery is where you're starting to see industry play more and more of a role because of the cloud computing and limitations and internet bandwidth and so on and so forth. And then the dissemination of that information, at least so that industry can then pick it up and do something with it. But they also deliver that data via various channels, and the Weather Service does a lot of work with it. There's probably way more to the box, but that's sort of a quick high-level view of like, what is the box?
I think it's a good foundation for us to start from here. So we're thinking about, you know, the sensing, bringing in of that data. That last mile, you know, is kind of that transition. I think it sounds like, especially could be the processing piece, be it cloud or otherwise, but also that delivery, that last mile. I know you recently wrote a blog that I think has some play here that I want to kind of pull in. And I think we're going to roll up our sleeves and have some fun on this podcast. You got at least one idea, and it may or may not be in that blog, but I think the idea that you have kind of stems from the thoughts that you had in there. You got at least one idea for our audience to think outside that box that we just helped define.
Yeah. I don't know if idea is the right term or just something that I'm thinking about that I wish we would all be thinking about. Maybe that's one way to think about it.
Philosophy. This is the definition of philosophy here.
Yes, our philosophical considerations here. Well, you know, you alluded to this blog, and it's not just in the blog, but the reality is there has been a rapid shift. And I mean a rapid shift, at least for some of us who have been around for a while, we're saying this is really fast, right? But a rapid shift in weather technology over the last 5 years or so. We're seeing big tech companies engage in the weather space, right? So we're talking about the Googles, the Microsofts, the Apples, the NVIDIAs of the world, right? And there's others too, right? And they're starting to offer weather data and services and really doing a lot in the space of AI. You know, at face value, it's really not all that surprising. I mean, weather's universally applicable, and it's really a great use case for AI. I talked a little bit about that in the blog. You know, if I were a company trying to sell cloud computing or AI services or make money off of advertising, I mean, weather is a really great place to start. So for me, it really isn't surprising that somebody picked up on this, right? But if we go back to the shift, right, I think what the shift is that rather than seeing government organizations sort of lead the development of weather prediction, we're seeing this happen in private industry. And again, specifically in big tech, which kind of bifurcating here, because to me, it's its own sector of private industry, right? Mm-hmm. You know, most recently, you can now run your own models using technologies developed right from Google DeepMind or NVIDIA, right? You don't have to rely on the government to do it. Now, the barrier to entry is still quite technical, right? So it's not like everybody's doing it, but it's a shift, right? And I want to first say, this is really exciting, actually. I mean, if you step back for a moment, you realize this is another, like, what's that term?
Step function.
Yeah. I was talking about like a pivot point or something.
That's inflection point.
Inflection point, right? Yeah. This is a great inflection point in the weather prediction space.
Yep.
But, you know, right to your question, I really can't help but think about the potential implications of this, however, right? And this, you know, so here I am even saying, wait, the box is changing and I'm getting a little uncomfortable, right? So I can't help but think to myself, okay, what are the implications here? We said earlier that weather prediction and access to weather information is a life-saving endeavor, right? Not just lives, but we talk about protection of property and businesses and, you know,
quality of life.
Quality of life, arguably the entire economic system around the globe is impacted by this. So I started looking for kind of counterexamples or cautionary tales. This is kind of how I approach anything in life where I'm uncomfortable, right? What I try not to do is look for bias confirmation. I try to challenge and see if I can kind of, am I onto something or am I just overthinking things, right? And so in the news, especially in the US, I had often been seeing articles about things like insulin and other pharmaceuticals. And it caught my attention because just like in weather, these too are life-saving technologies. And actually, in most cases, they are developed by the pharmaceuticals version of big tech. And so because of that, they are priced according to market value and per the rules of capitalism, profits made, and therefore those technologies advance. Pretty logical. And so between that and the competitive landscape that you typically see, there's a motivation to keep developing those life-saving technologies. So on one side, you say, well, great, you know, maybe it's a good thing that industry is playing a bigger role because maybe this will advance faster. But on the other side of the coin, many of these life-saving technologies and pharmaceuticals, they're not accessible by those who need it. At least that's what we see in the news. So admittedly, I'm basing all of this on what I read online. So of course, it must all be true, right? But seriously, I'm not an expert in pharmaceuticals, but I'm reading and doing the research I can here to make sense of this. So really using it as an example of what might happen if private industry has ownership and is leading the development of the entire weather prediction process. And if I summarize that, the questions I'm asking myself are, you know, what if the shoulders of the giants we're standing on in the future are a Microsoft or an NVIDIA? What if the GFS model that we get from NOAA today isn't needed anymore, right? Like, these are big questions and really worth spending time thinking about. What does that look like? I mean, the entire box you just talked about no longer exists.
Those are scary questions, right? There's some that just want to shut down those kind of arguments that you just put forward, or those not really arguments, but questions we should ask ourselves without having a really, like, just stepping back and having a conversation. I think to your point that we've talked about before, what if in a world 5 or 10 years from now, the GFS doesn't exist? Let's start to think about maybe the benefits of that GFS. It's not really the GFS, it's that capability at the end of the day. The ability of that capability to be delivered faster, maybe more efficiently, cheaper, you know, for the taxpayer at the end of the day. I go back to this, like, why people are afraid of moving outside the status quo is it's outside of the comfort zone, right? So how do we promote a conversation around the question you just posed there, that kind of connection with the insulin example? How do we promote that conversation, that dialogue, to get people thinking outside this box?
You know, if you would have, if you go back 20 years, when, is it 20 years when the Wharf was, might be, geez, the Wharf model was coming out.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a shift too for the industry. right? And it was a community model and it went out and it made all these differences. And back then, if you would have said, gosh, you know, who's going to lead the next major revolution in weather, we would have all assumed, again, would have been in the government.
And, yeah.
You know, maybe I look back now and think, well, that was naive to think about, right? But, you know, I think it absolutely matters because we kind of have this opposite situation of pharmaceuticals right now. We have a life-saving technology that's freely available, right? Serves as an economic driver. We kind of talked about that. And keep in mind, there's a lot of nuances to this, a lot of details that we haven't kind of gone into and a lot of things to consider, but we could spend all of our lives talking about the hurdles. So let's just imagine that those hurdles are not there, right? The conversation I think is important because on one side of the coin, these advances are happening very fast because they're not happening in government. I mean, one of the benefits of government is the actual taking the time to make sure things are done right. You know, you had Amy on the podcast not so long ago, and Amy's leading a lot of efforts about the kind of concerns many of us have about some of these AI technologies.
Right.
And so there's definitely a bit of a concern of if the GFS isn't there, can you trust the output of these models is a big question. One of the things I alluded to in my recent blog was that as exciting as this is, the ability to run these models using AI very quickly, they didn't fix any of the underlying problems in numerical weather prediction. I mean, why don't we have perfect forecasts then if AI solved these problems, right? It made it faster. And again, I don't want to take away from it because it's very exciting, but it hasn't fixed any of the underlying challenges in the observation gaps and our knowledge of weather. Traditionally, we have a computational limitation. So AI is helping with that. We have to remember that there's a lot of training involved, right? Another thing that I think a lot about in the future, when I think about government versus industry, is that, you know, industry has its own limitations in terms of its funding mechanism is revenue. And so if industry is spending all of this money developing AI technologies, and then they come and find out that it's kind of hard to make money off of it because the world has had it for free for so long, right?
They walk away.
What if the GFS model goes away because nobody's using it? And then all of a sudden industry decides, I'm going to stop doing this.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's a valid point. It becomes an ethical dilemma then for the government to be like, well, you know, if you think about 5 or 10 years from now, I don't know. I see a world where there's not a GFS, but there's got to be some level of at least a hybrid situation so that if that scenario that you just articulated comes to fruition and company X, who's been running, you know, the go-to model walks away, that there's still always something there. But I wonder, Scott, if that's going to happen. I mean, you've got several companies already dabbling in this space, right? And maybe it's not 5 or 10 years from now, it's not NVIDIA or Microsoft or Google running, but maybe it's some small startup that's able to do this on, you know, an efficient and small scale as, you know, technology advances. So maybe the private sector is able to keep that engine running. It seems to me that we're already kind of seeing, I think, multiple parts of the industry start to gravitate towards this because they know the AI space, and now they're just trying to tap into the domain expertise of the atmospheric sciences, right?
Yeah, it seems silly to go back to the mattress example, but the industry was much better suited to commercialize the faux mattress than NASA was, right? And so maybe in a way, the government has kind of played its role in numerical weather prediction, and now industry is going to go out and commercialize it and advance it. And maybe it comes back to really, I mean, some of us hate the word oversight, but somebody needs to watch out to make sure that there's a good quality in these things, right?
Well, let's come back to your insulin example, right? I think that's a good example here because we have talked about, like, in the past, like, the role for government is, you know, to essentially protect the citizens. You can go into the Constitution and find the real role of our government. But I mean, like, safety and welfare of our citizens, right? So let's go back to the insulin example. You know, how do we bring that example back in? There's private industry out there creating, you know, these pharmaceuticals for insulin. There's a growing need for this. I mean, I think if you looked at the rate of diabetes and other kind of insulin-needed maladies in our society, I think the need for that is continuing to go up, right? Without insulin, these populations would not survive, or they would not survive. They would not have a quality of life or longevity of life. Likewise, in weather, the role of government here in this case is like part of the protection of people is making sure that if there's a tornado bearing down on a community, that they're warned properly. If there's a hurricane or there is extreme heat coming down the road, they get the information in a timely manner. And you don't want mixed messages then in that case, right? You want them coming from an authoritative source. But so how do we tie this insulin example to ensuring American citizens still get safety messages? The concern, I think, from American people and the government is, like, if the private sector is doing those kind of things or providing information for those kind of things, that we're selling safety, essentially. And there's just kind of a moral kind of thing that you kind of go, huh, how does that work, right?
Yeah, this is where my insulin example kind of breaks down, because I don't understand why is there not more competition driving the price down, and therefore, right? So there's something I'm missing in the insulin example, which actually may just come from, you know, the fact that weather did not start as a privatized, you know, competitive landscape thing. But, you know, the point of it, the life-saving aspect is where the two do come together. You know, in other countries, insulin is controlled, the price of it, the affordability of it, the availability of it, right? I wonder how much of that is because it's not controlled in the US. And, you know, because if you quote unquote control the pricing and make it freely available, then the industry loses all of its motivation to advance it, right? I mean, that's sort of the double-edged sword of it.
I mean, is there a space for a weather marketplace kind of thing, you know, where the government does continue to serve as that arbiter, ultimate arbiter, but maybe I'm questioning myself when I ask that, because at some points maybe the private sector walks away if their input's not, you know, taken into consideration anyway. Like,
yeah, you know, there's two things coming to my mind. First of all, I'm going to guess that there's going to be some listening to this podcast who are going to say, none of this matters because the AI of today still needs the numerical weather prediction models for training. I just want to make the point that that's only true today. There will be a future where that is not the case, because the last frontier for AI is the data assimilation piece. And that's a whole different discussion for another time.
A whole other podcast.
But I think you said something articulated very well, that I'm going to use the word official. Like, that's one of the things about, if the government says it, it's official, right? And so you're right. I think there will always be a need for government in weather for that official, you know, so there isn't mixed, especially during times of crisis. Like, how do you make decisions if you don't have that official information?
Yeah.
I think the real question in all of this is, if you look at the box that is government today, what if the numerical weather prediction piece was no longer their responsibility? In a way, you almost have a stronger need of government then for the oversight and the official aspects of it. But then there's also this other piece, that none of that numerical weather prediction AI replacement stuff works without the measurement background. It's interesting to think of a box that had a piece of its core removed, and what does that look like?
Yeah.
And again, we can sit here and debate all day whether that's really going to happen. If you would have asked me even 5 years ago, I would have said, but now after seeing what I've seen recently, I'm thinking to myself, we really need to be having the discussion of what that government box looks like. And actually, a lot of us need to know the answer for our own careers and you know, private strategies and all these other kind of pieces, right? These are all important things to think about.
And maybe, you know, if you think about the value chain of, you know, weather information, all the way from the initial sensing to the delivery of information for decisions, then that sensing piece, there's a private sector part of that too, but that sensing piece remains responsibility within the government to help manage in general, manage and provide for the private sector to run the models potentially and deliver to that last mile. And that last mile can be agriculture companies, it can be aviation companies, and it can be back to the government then at that point to be that ultimate arbiter in an emergency or crisis situation, so that Because what you don't want at the end of the day is thousands of county emergency operations centers having their own source of safety information. And so the government can become that consumer then from the private sector when it comes to the numerical weather prediction at the end of the day.
Yeah. If I had to predict anything, that's likely this scenario. I don't know when, I don't know what that looks like, what that means to the landscape of jobs, right? But I think that is a very realistic scenario where the government is now the customer of individuals running this numerical weather prediction, recognizing that they were this catalyst for making all of it happen, right? Which in a way is another role of government. I mean, if the government can use taxpayer dollars to be an economic driver, that's a good thing. It creates jobs. It creates all these type of things. But to your point, today, industry and other companies have, I mean, look at Forecast Watch. It's a company that looks at how everybody's forecasts are performing. You know, those kind of charts help you see exactly why the ECMWF is the preferred model for most industries. But it costs money, which is a limitation in a lot of ways. At some point, though, if the government is the customer and disseminating that information for official decision making and, you know, consistent decision making, now all of a sudden they have to be the ones with the requirements, right? And actually, I think they're very good suited for that.
I'm just thinking of a symbiotic. This could actually promote a much more natural kind of symbiotic relationship between public, private, and academic. I think there's a framework and model that could be developed with what I think what we're talking about here. When we were at AMS, you know what I heard, you know, the director of NOAA, director of the Weather Service, like they're both acknowledging this rapid acceleration in technology. And you can already see the wheels turning, particularly when you hear the director of the National Weather Service talk about the way that he has to reimagine the talent management, the human capital, and that sort of thing of what the Weather Service is really good at. And that's providing good quality weather prediction information to, you know, to the country, but specifically safety, right? And I think he's got a big focus on emergency management, emergency operations centers. I think there's a framework here, right? And I think what we have to get people to do is buy into this as a possibility in reality without cringing right away, without saying, no, that's not possible right away. And that's what happens with the status quo. People don't like change. People like comfort. They like the box that they're in. Anything that disrupts that is a challenge to either their livelihood or something along those lines. So it's just at some point, an idea like this, I think, will get traction. And you just need more first adopters and first adopters within the government to say, hey, this is something that we should get out ahead of, work with Congress, and make this a reality, right? And then the government gets to control that, right?
Yeah. I actually like this train of thought because the motivation doesn't change. There's the underlying responsibilities and needs in terms of making sure that official consistent information is put out, that people are protected, that citizens are knowledgeable and protected, right? That their taxpayer dollars are going to something that benefits them. All of that remains the same. Where you get the technology doesn't necessarily impact that. Now, it's uncomfortable to actually think about, even for folks like myself. And at the risk of sounding critical, though, I mean, I don't know that I have any confidence that the government's going to be able to catch up and play a leading role in AI development right now. I mean, that's for a lot of reasons, you know, and I just don't know how you stop the train. So if you recognize that, okay, well, you can't stop the train, nor should you, right? If it's going to benefit everybody in the long run, now you just have to go back to your underlying responsibilities and say to yourself, okay, how do we become an enabler of this?
Right.
Because I think that, you know, again, going back to insulin, we don't want to be in this situation where, I mean, there's lobbying going on and there's this like war of news articles trying to sway opinion, you know, who should own this and who should own that. It's an interesting discussion. I got to admit, I've had this discussion with some friends and colleagues outside of weather, and they kind of chuckle at me because they say to me, this is just capitalism. This is just the way that it works, right? And I say to myself, yeah, but this is too close to home for me, and it's very uncomfortable. Right. And so I think for a lot of us in the weather space, we have to kind of recognize that for a minute. It is uncomfortable to think about what could be. And you know, maybe only half of what we've even discussed today is going to come to fruition, where there's things that we don't even know about yet. But, you know, hopefully it's just not two of us talking about this, right?
Well, that's why we've got the podcast here, right? Yep. We're gonna push this out so more people talk about it. Because I think at the end of the day, I think a lot of what we are talking about, some of it is probably already happening. But I think it behooves the government certainly to strategize on this, create a roadmap that incorporates these ideas and acknowledges the realities of what is happening. You've got Google Graphcast out there, NVIDIA, you've got these models that, like, these things are, to your point, are happening really fast. There's a long ways to go there in terms of, like, okay, some black box kind of stuff going on. And, you know, we want to make sure that the AI is ethical and that sort of thing. So there's still a lot of work to be done there, but you still need, I think, very strategic minded folks within the government actually putting together these roadmaps, sitting down with the long-term budgeting with, you know, congressional leaders and that sort of thing to get out ahead of this. And then they can actually continue to have control over how that gets, you know, implemented. They're able to bring private sector and academia along, but it's an evolution. And that's, I mean, like, I think a lot of this comes down to the mind, and folks on the podcast aren't going to be able to see me moving my fingers back and forth in terms of, like, it's money, right? And, you know, I think the big government and agencies and the congressionals who have those government programs in their districts or whatnot are going to want to know, well, what does this mean for the people in my district? And, you know, is money going to be taken away from my agency? I mean, like, it always, almost always devolves into a food fight on money. Yeah. Is why the status quo in the box sometimes remains unopened. I don't know. So that's probably a whole nother podcast.
But there's also a responsibility on industry. You know, we've stood on the shoulders of the government giants for a long time, and it's also our responsibility to help them. And what I mean by that is, if you think about it today, I am a customer of many of these companies, data providers, model providers, so on and so forth. So it becomes my responsibility to kind of make sense of the marketing spins and understand what the reality is. And the government's going to have to learn how to do that also. If you read some of these articles out there, like, this is all solved and it's done, right? And it's better. But, like, when you really kind of put your science hat on, you start to realize, well, they haven't actually solved the underlying problems yet. And I stress yet, because that's coming, right? I won't go into all the nuances here, but, you know, it is a lot of work, some folks like myself, to try to figure out what's real and what isn't, and what do we actually do about it. I mean, part of that's just a competitive landscape. But again, all of us really do have the same goal, whether we're in industry, academia, or government, right? Like, we want to save lives. We want to protect assets. You know, we want to continue to be economic drivers. Otherwise, our funding mechanism in industry doesn't exist. It's the purpose, right? It's interesting to think about. Absolutely.
Well, this has been awesome. I think we could have, like, three or four different podcasts stemming from this. I like this idea of thinking outside the box, being innovative and creative. So maybe this kicks off a outside the box series. I want to get into our last few questions here. And one of them we've already kind of talked about, but so I don't know if you have anything different to say, but one of the things, this is a weather podcast after all, although Jeff Cunningham would say it's a technology podcast, but prediction time, what's one dramatic change you expect in the weather and climate world 10 years from now? And maybe we already talked about it.
Yeah, I kind of alluded to it. I don't know that I'm right or wrong, but if I had to really go out on a limb, I don't know that there's a need for a GFS, ECMWF, and other global models. I could go into a whole reason why in a whole nother podcast, but not to self-promote, but I do blog about this often, and there's more of that coming. So
Awesome. Well, we will have our folks in tune with those blogs. We'll put one of those in the show notes for sure. What's a piece of advice you have for up and coming meteorologists looking for a future in our field?
I love this question. I'm going to give you two things. They're kind of my top two pieces of advice that I give in basically every talk I do to students. The first one is get started. You've heard me talk about this. You know, many students I talk to these days are either looking for that perfect job or they're looking for a job that looks like the kind of role that was described to them during their studies. And the reality is you have to get started somewhere. And so, you know, you're not going to find that perfect. If you do find the perfect job, good for you. And I'm always jealous of people who get to do what they wanted to do since they were two for their whole career, right? But don't be afraid to just kind of get started on something. And the second piece is completely different. It's to really spend time understanding who you are. You know, the STEM field in general doesn't think too much about the psychology of humans as much as maybe they should when it comes to jobs. But like, what makes you tick? What are you wired to do well? I know I've at least found that, you know, if you can find a career that benefits from the kind of skills that you're kind of inherently wired to do, not only are you going to be happier, but you'll find your career advancing at a much faster pace. That's a lot easier said than done because we don't do a lot of that work in college these days, but I think there's some universities catching on and moving that along. So,
yeah, I think that's great advice. And I wish I would have had that advice 22 years ago, 24 years ago, I guess now at this point. That's great. I appreciate that. All right. So we always like to end our podcast with three quick lightning round questions. And you alluded to maybe this first one, but you mentioned Twister earlier, and they're actually coming up with a sequel.
It looks like
later this summer. So we'll see how that.
I'm weirdly excited.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So what's the most memorable weather event in your life?
Honestly, Hurricane Katrina lifted up my roof and put it back down. And I was about 300 miles from the coast. And so that was the first time that I really understood the power of hurricanes. And I was in a series of townhomes, so it lifted all of our roofs up, moved it 3 inches to the left, and set it back down.
Holy cow. Yeah.
And that was in Huntsville, Alabama. So for those of you who want to look that up on a map, I think Hurricane Katrina was a Category 1 at that point, so I wasn't even worried about it. And so now I have a very different perspective on the power of hurricanes.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. That'll put things into perspective really quickly, for sure.
Yep.
All right, choose your adventure. Tornado chasing, skydiving, space tourist, or name your own.
I'm going to have to name my own. Those other three sound great, but I'm such a people person that I think I'd like to visit the locations of all the most like ancient human activities. Put me in a city that's 1,000 years or older, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. So that's my adventure. Yeah.
That's awesome. So let me know when you plan that trip, and I'll be there to go on that one with you. It's cool. All right, last one. What's your superpower?
I like to think that I get people thinking. In fact, I find that I exhaust people sometimes with it. But I'm always about progress and seeing how do we help people. So if I have to pick one, it's really sort of that ability to influence and get people thinking.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate that we've done that on this podcast for the last 45 minutes or so. And I hope we get the audience thinking about a lot of things. We didn't even get a chance to talk about some of the other things you have going on outside of work, 1,000 Gretas and other things like that. Put a note in the show notes, though. Because I do think that work is important. And to your last answer there, it's getting people thinking. Getting people thinking outside the box about the possibilities of what the future of this field might look like. Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Triple Point today. And I'm looking forward to actually more conversations like this in the future with you. Been great to have you on the show, brother.
Great. Thanks so much, man.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's Triple Point podcast. If you liked it, subscribe to our newsletter at triplepointpodcast.com. Give us a shout and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast station and tell your friends about it. Or you can email us at triplepointpodcast@81degrees.com. Until next time, have a great week.